Updates from Kyiv on the efforts to evacuate Ukrainian fighters in the Azovstal steel and ironworks plant.
Another 7 buses have left Azovstal with Ukrainian soldiers, reportedly. For the moment, we don't know exactly the amount of soldiers in the buses.
Plus, what does Russian President Vladimir Putin's remarks about Finland and Sweden joining NATO say about the war?
I'm not sure that Putin has actually changed his stance in terms of objecting to a NATO expansion, but certainly I think he's softened his rhetoric, and I think that it's not really a big surprise.
And later in the program, an exclusive look inside the training ground for the Belarusian regiment known as Pahonia in Poland. Today is Tuesday, May 17th, and from the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine's military worked on Tuesday to evacuate its remaining fighters from the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol, where 3 months of Russian bombing has left the besieged port city in ruins. Ukrainian officials said that more than 250 fighters were evacuated on Monday, and not long ago, I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv to get the latest.
Yesterday in the evening on May 16, we received confirmation that evacuation of the soldiers from Azovstal began. Before that, the leader of the Azov battalion announced that they fulfilled the main task that they had, and now their main goal is to save lives of their soldiers, of the Ukrainian soldiers. So what do we know? We know that 53 heavy wounded soldiers were evacuated to Novoazovsk. It's occupied territory in Donetsk region. There they are going to get all the medical support needed. At least this is the agreement. Another 211 Ukrainian soldiers were evacuated to Olenivka. It's another city in Donetsk region, which is also occupied. All soldiers are waiting for the procedure of exchange, so they should be exchanged with Russian soldiers. So this is for the moment. Also, just a couple of minutes ago, we got also information that another 7 buses have left Azovstal with Ukrainian soldiers, reportedly. For the moment, we don't know exactly the amount of soldiers in the buses. And we don't know the direction where they're going, but as I already mentioned, the evacuation is ongoing. So Ukrainian officials confirmed that this would be done in the next couple of days.
And does this mean that all the Ukrainian fighters in the Azovstal complex have been evacuated?
Not yet. What we know that for the moment, reportedly around a couple of hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers remain in Azovstal. But according to Ukrainian officials, they all are going to be evacuated.
Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Russian President Vladimir Putin appeared to back away on Monday from Moscow's objections to both Sweden and Finland joining NATO, saying that he had no issues with the Nordic countries entering the U.S.-led military alliance they now aim to join in response to his invasion of Ukraine. Reuters' Tamara Lindstrom has those details.
The comments appeared to mark a major shift in rhetoric.
I want to inform you, dear colleagues, that Russia has no problem with those states. It hasn't. So in this regard, expansion by the addition of those countries poses no direct threat for us. But the expansion of military infrastructure into this territory would certainly provoke our response. What that will be, we will see what threats are created for us.
Moscow for decades has cast NATO expansion as a direct threat to Russia's security, including citing it as a justification for the invasion of Ukraine itself. Russia's invasion has shaken up Europe's security architecture and forced Sweden and Finland to choose sides after staying out of NATO during the Cold War. Finland and Sweden now say they want the protection offered by NATO's treaty, under which an attack on any member is considered an attack on all. Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson made the announcement Monday.
Our 200-year-long standing policy of military non-alignment has served Sweden well. But the issue at hand is whether military non-alignment will keep serving as well. And Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine is not only illegal and indefensible, it also undermines the European security order that Sweden builds its security on.
Swedish and Finnish officials have said Putin has only himself to blame for their decisions to join NATO. But the plans might be hitting a snag. NATO member Turkey said it would not approve either bid, with Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan saying Monday that Sweden and Finland should not bother sending delegations to Ankara to persuade Turkey. Sweden and Finland need each of NATO's 30 members to approve their applications.
Tamara Lindstrom of Reuters News. The European Union's top diplomat Josep Borrell said on Tuesday that unverified data indicates that Russia may have lost 15% of its troops since the war began. So, what do these latest developments mean for Putin's war effort? Emily Holland is an assistant professor in the Russia Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College. And I began our conversation by asking her about Putin's Monday remarks.
Sure. Well, I'm not sure that Putin has actually changed his stance in terms of objecting to a NATO expansion, but certainly I think he's softened his rhetoric. And I think that it's not really a big surprise. I'm not sure that Russia ever really judged that either Finland or Sweden was going to be a major security threat to Russia. Of course, the Russian state and Putin in particular has always been extremely opposed to expanding NATO membership. And, you know, the expansion to include Sweden and Finland actually sort of fulfills his narrative, the narrative that he's been telling the Russian people for almost, you know, close to 20 years, which is that NATO is a hostile organization aimed at reducing Russia's own security by expanding along its borders. So this sort of just fits in with that narrative. But at the same time, I don't believe that he or anybody in Russia really believes that there is any sort of major security threat from particularly Finland and Sweden. It's just an overall expansion of something that he's opposed to, certainly.
Emily, I want to turn our attention to Ukraine and specifically the Azovstal Steel and Ironworks plant inside Mariupol. Those fighters have been fending off Russian attacks for months. What does their laying down of arms and evacuation mean in the broader context of the war that's taking place in their country?
Well, as you mentioned, the Russian military has expended a tremendous amount of effort in its attempts to capture Mariupol. And the removal of these last Azovstal defenders, you know, really show that they have succeeded in that. But it's taken them a ton of effort, a ton of manpower. They've lost a lot of equipment. They've put tons into it. And at this point, you know, we knew they were going to take it. It's been taken for a while. And we knew from the effort that the Russian military put into it that they were not going to let it go. The removal of these more than, I think, 250 last of these defenders, Ukrainian servicemen, today is just sort of an official recognition by the Ukrainian state that they have lost Mariupol and they've lost that battle and they're removing those final, you know, very, very brave defenders up for the Ukrainian state. They're moving them out. But, you know, Mariupol shows that, you know, the Russian military has just had a really challenging time sort of achieving what they thought would be relatively easy military goals in Ukraine. But given the effort that they put into Mariupol, it was very clear that they were not going to stop until they had sort of really taken this area. And it was a crucial area for their military goals. So that is set in stone now. The Russian military is there. They are, I think, as we speak right now, removing the last of the Azovstal defenders. And so Ukraine is now moved out of Mariupol. But what they were very brave and what they did was they really tied the Russian military up in Mariupol and gave the rest of the Ukrainian military a chance to sort of keep defending areas in eastern Ukraine and keep Russia sort of relegated to areas in eastern Ukraine rather than moving further west.
Emily Holland is an assistant professor in the Russia Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College. Emily, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. On Wednesday, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu meets in Washington with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Ankara's reluctance to support Finland and Sweden's NATO membership bids is expected to dominate the talks during the Wednesday visit, with the foreign minister expected to have a long list of demands. Dorian Jones is up next.
Once a close ally of Washington, Ankara has seen relations strained over Turkey's poor human rights record and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's close ties with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Turkey's strong backing of Ukraine in the face of Russia's invasion has offered an opportunity to reset U.S.-Turkish relations. And analysts predict Çavuşoğlu's visit to Washington will help that process. But Aslı Aydıntaşbaş, a senior fellow at the European Council, warns Erdogan's threat to veto Sweden and Finland's NATO membership bids is casting a shadow over the visit.
It certainly complicates the visit, but it also makes it more important. The Biden administration started out with a policy of social distancing, retrenchment from the Middle East, and also no longer treating Turkey as the big geopolitical prize in a larger chess game. And I think Turkey is showing that it's not going to let that happen. And of course, Ukraine war has clearly enhanced once again Turkey's strategic location and importance.
On Monday, Erdogan accused Finland and Sweden of supporting terrorist organizations fighting Turkey, referring to Kurdish groups. He said Stockholm and Helsinki shouldn't even bother to send diplomatic delegations to change his mind. Erdogan's hardening stance, analysts warn, will likely add to concerns in Washington over the Turkish president's close ties with Putin. In addition, Turkey's purchase of Russia's S-400 missile system prompted Washington to impose military sanctions on Ankara. Soli Özel, an international relations specialist at Istanbul's Kadir Has University, says one of Çavuşoğlu's objectives, persuading Washington to allow the sale of F-16 fighter jets to Turkey, will likely be complicated by renewed questions over where Erdogan's ultimate allegiances lie.
There will be, of course, voices raising that question, and I'm afraid it might also lead to a much more negative sentiment about selling the F-16s and the kits for the upgrading of the existing F-16s in the U.S. Congress. In that sense, also, I don't find the move such a public move, terribly advisable.
Russian media on Tuesday announced Putin was planning to visit Turkey in the coming days, a report that has not been confirmed by Ankara, but will likely add to the unease among Turkey's Western allies, including Washington. Aaron Stein, head of the Pennsylvania-based Foreign Policy Research Institute, says sentiments in Washington toward Turkey are likely to become only more entrenched.
It's more or less reinforced that Ankara is going to pursue its own interests. And so again, some people suggest it's time to sell them the F-16, and others suggest that we need compromise on the S-400. But things happen, and rabbits can be pulled out of hats. But this one has proved particularly sticky. With the S-400 and the F-16.
Analysts also predict Çavuşoğlu will underline the importance of restoring closer communication between the country's two presidents. How such requests are met may depend on Washington's approach and whether U.S. officials decide to confront or acquiesce to Erdogan's veto threats on Sweden and Finland. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Since the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Belarus has been a launching pad for Russian forces. VOA's Miroslava Gongadze has this exclusive look inside the training ground for the Belarusian regiment known as Pahonia inside Poland.
Critics say Belarus has become an accomplice in Putin's war on Ukraine, but many Belarusians who held peaceful protest in 2020 against their longtime ruler, Alexander Lukashenko, have decided to take up arms for Ukraine. Many see an opportunity to free their country from dictatorship. At this training ground in Poland, volunteers are taking their first battle lessons. A former Polish police officer, now a business owner, and his war veteran partner are training Belarusians who sign up for new regiment, known as Pahonia. After a week of training in Poland, the volunteers are transferred to base in Ukraine for a more vigorous, months-long exercise. The regiment's leader expects 40 people to sign up each month, and for the numbers to steadily grow.
They are highly motivated Belarusians. They have only two targets. One target is to help the brothers in Ukraine, because we have a common enemy.
the volunteers are resolute in their decision to gain combat experience. Andrei says his family is in Belarus.
It's not only the war of Ukraine. This is the war of all, of the whole free world, and Belarus as well, because Belarus is almost 30 years under dictatorship, and it's very painful for us, for the Russian people who really want to be free. And our desire, our dream, after a defeat of Putin, we hope that the regime of Lukashenko will be destroyed as well.
For Kirill, who left Belarus long ago, this fight is about freedom as well. He started helping Ukrainians buy military equipment and then realized he had a big battle at home to support.
I realized that we have some Belarusian volunteers, military volunteers, and they are not very good equipped. So we decided to start help them. We start to send them equipment.
Kirill hopes to show that many Belarusian people, unlike Lukashenko, do not support Putin's aggression.
That's our guilty before the Ukrainian people, because for now we are who hold the Belarusian passport. We are the enemies for them, because our country, which is also occupied by the tyrant Lukashenko, and bomb or shelling from Belarus territory to Ukrainian cities and villages, and only that way we should provide as much help as we can to Ukraine and their people in their fighting with the Russian aggression.
Kirill, like many, was inspired by protests in Belarus 2 years ago. Back then, their protest was peaceful, and protesters were not prepared for the brutality of Lukashenko's forces. Now, Lukashenko's opponents are working to get ready for battle. The Belarusian leadership in exile last month endorsed the Pohonia regiment. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the woman who is believed by many to be the rightful winner of Belarusians' 2020 election, on Twitter, referred to the unit as a base for the new professional Belarusian army. The unit's leader, Vadim Prokopyev, sees the endorsement as a first step toward freeing Belarus from Lukashenko.
I think the time has come that our leadership, our political leadership in exile, take more desperate and more decisive measures. And if Ukrainians will see enough potential and enough power, I think the recognition of a government in exile is a very good and strong move.
He says his regiment is growing, and soon BOA has learned some experienced trainers, including U.S. Army veterans, will join the fight. Miroslava Gongadze, BOA News, Warsaw.
The European Union again failed to agree on an oil embargo against Russia on Monday as part of a sixth package of sanctions over the war in Ukraine. Hungary remains a key holdout, demanding a high price for greenlighting the package. Lisa Bryant explains.
Signs of exasperation against Hungary emerged at a meeting of European Union foreign ministers in Brussels, including from Ukraine's top envoy, Dmytro Kuleba, who was invited to the talks. An oil embargo against Russia, he said, was essential.
It's clear who is holding the issue, but time is running out, because every day Russia keeps making money and investing this money into the war.
Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielius Landsbergis also expressed frustration.
Now, unfortunately, we are the whole union is being held hostage by one member state who cannot help us find their consensus.
The EU needs unanimous agreement from its 27 members to push through each set of sanctions. Until now, that's happened. An oil embargo would be the toughest sanction so far, hurting Moscow's ability to finance the war. It would also hit some European countries highly dependent on Russian energy. But Hungary, already considered an EU maverick on other issues, is especially putting on the brakes. Reports say Budapest wants hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation and possibly more to transition from Russian oil imports. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said the conversations with Hungary were largely technical. He offered no timeline for coming to an agreement. Still, some EU members are hopeful that a breakthrough is only days or weeks away.
One thing is clear, I think it's clear for everybody in the Council, we have to get rid of the energy dependency of the European Union with respect to oil, gas and coal coming from Russia.
Borrell said the war in Ukraine has tested the bloc in key ways, not just the conflict itself, but it is also testing Europe's energy resiliency as it unwinds its dependency on Russian supplies and its very legitimacy. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Refugees who have fled the Ukrainian city of Mariupol headed to the cities of Zaporizhia and Dnipro to find safety. In Dnipro, the city has opened a special center to accommodate the newcomers. Anna Rice narrates this story to round us out.
Olga Shatska and her 3-year-old daughter Darina are among the many Mariupol refugees who have come to the center in Dnipro. After she registers, Shatska will start receiving special food packages, like all other refugees.
We got an appointment for Tuesday.
Tatiana Prikhotska is another one of the more than 50,000 refugees who have come to Dnipro from Mariupol in recent weeks. She recounts her perilous journey.
People would first drive for 3 days, then go on foot. Children, strollers, some carrying kids on their shoulders. Oh God, it's so tough when I think about it. We were driving on the highway. It was such a nightmare. There was so much shooting and shelling. I don't know how the woman who was driving the car we were in, I don't know how she managed, but we finally arrived to Manhush.
From Manhush, Prikhotska, together with other refugees, made their way to Dnipro. There, she quickly found a refugee center and received groceries there.
Rice porridge, vegetable oil, sugar, wheat, and something sweet.
The humanitarian aid hub called I Am Mariupol is set up in Dnipro's central city library. Many of the volunteers themselves are refugees from Mariupol. They reissue documents and help people find lost relatives and look for jobs. Consultants help refugees on financial matters, like what to do about property lost in Mariupol, insurance claims, and how to get financial aid. A psychologist and a doctor are also on hand.
What tragic events take place in our hometown every single day? That's why the Mariupol City Council decided to create such a center.
It's the second time general practitioner from Mariupol, Alena Matyozova, has fled the war. In 2014, when her native town in the Donetsk region was occupied by Russian separatists, she moved to Mariupol. This year, the city she has learned to call home was destroyed by the Russian forces, and Alena fled again.
I loved Mariupol more than any other city, more even than my hometown. My employer provided me with an apartment there. I just had time to furnish it, and the war began.
Residents from other Ukrainian cities come to this refugee center as well. On average, officials say the center receives about 200 people a day, and all the services for the refugees are free. For Yaroslava Mavchan in Dnipro, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up with the latest developments on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of our entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice
of America. Washington, D.C.